always done and always will.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Chantel Destra. It's about a week until the state budget deadline, and negotiations are underway. Legislative leaders officially kick things off by convening the first General Conference Committee meeting, also known to Albany politicos as the Mothership. The meeting came after the chambers released their respective One House budget proposals, which were about $13 billion more than what the governor proposed. Let's unpack some of the highlights. The two chambers, for the most part, were aligned on addressing housing with the inclusion of some form of tenant protections. The chambers also included increased taxes on wealthy New Yorkers, while the governor has said that this is a non-starter for negotiations. And the legislature also veered away from the controversial education plan Hochul proposed. On the other side of the aisle, Republicans slammed Democrats for what they describe as a budget that does not address affordability. But one thing is clear. There is a lot for the leaders to try to come to an agreement on before April 1st. In the meantime, David Lombardo of the Capitol Press Room sat down with Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger to unpack the chamber's position on some of the most watched budget items. Here's that conversation.
Well, welcome to the show, Senator. I really appreciate making the time.
Certainly. Glad you're here with me.
So in the One House budgets proposed by the Democrats in the Senate and Assembly, the spending that they envision is above and beyond what the governor called for in her executive budget. In order to pay for that, the Democrats in the legislature have advanced higher taxes on wealthy New Yorkers. In the Senate in particular, there's an increased income tax on New Yorkers making more than $5 million and above, as well as an increase on corporations making more than, I believe, $5 million annually. Why is that the right balance to strike for the Senate Dems in particular, the increased spending and the increased taxes?
Well, to start, nobody ever wants to increase taxes, but you need to provide the services and the programs that the people of New York need. And we believe that we made very modest proposed increases in a number of different sources of revenue. You mentioned two. One is an increase in taxes for people making over $5 million a year, and then a bump if you make more than $25 million. Well, just to start, this is your taxable income, which anyone who has $5 million or $25 million of taxable income has dramatically more actual income, because there's so many ways to shelter income and to not take income as quote-unquote cash when you have that level of wealth. So the changes we made would have absolutely zero impact on the lifestyle or the spending ability of anyone in these categories. These people have, you know, they are the 1% of the 1%. And they actually don't spend that kind of money, and they're earning it at a much faster and higher level than actually they will probably ever spend. So we feel very comfortable saying we need some additional funds for important programs in New York State. We're asking you to, yes, make the sacrifice of paying a little bit more in your taxes, but we're very confident it will have no impact on their lives. Now, on the corporate tax, it's also only if the corporation nets more than $5 million a year. So these are quite large corporations, and the majority of them aren't even actually here in New York. They're national and international companies that sell to us in New York, and they will continue to sell to us in New York. But it's not even a storyline of, well, would they pick up and leave if we have a higher tax rate on them? It has nothing to do with small or medium or community or local-based businesses. So again, we believe that that is an appropriate decision. And in fact, our corporate taxes on high-earning large corporations is lower than quite a few states.
And those taxes are going to generate potentially billions of dollars in additional revenue. So can you talk about what the Senate Democrats in particular envision spending those additional dollars on?
Sure. So we think those two tax combined tax proposals will bring us in about $2.2 billion a year combined. And we have a full and robust package of changes to the governor's budget. I'd say one of the biggest discussions has been around not allowing cuts in public school funding. The governor proposed fairly dramatic cuts in public school funding that would impact 50% of the school districts in the state. Now, school districts function under knowing what their budgets are year after year, being able to hire or keep the staff they have, and the concept that in 1 year you would cut 50% of the school districts would literally leave them in a crisis at this moment because they've already made their decisions and their plans for what next school year starting September 1 looks like. So for 50% of the districts to face reductions in the amount of money they're getting in state aid would truly be damaging and impact, you know, half of the state of New York. So we put that money back. Last year, we, in agreement with the governor, adjusted the funding to finally meet our legal obligations to fully fund the formula base aid to every school district in the state. We spent decades fighting in court around this issue. We made commitments that then got pulled back because of economic problems and then the pandemic. Last year, we finally made the commitment to deliver full funding aid as committed to in previous years to every one of our school districts. And it's a year later, and the governor proposed reducing that commitment. We just thought that was wrong and would harm school children and their families. So we're putting that money back. That's one of the biggest changes we're making in the governor's budget. We also, in coordination with the assembly, actually found an opportunity to draw down $4 billion more from federal Medicaid funds. So it's not new taxes on the people of New York State. It's new federal money coming to us. It has to be spent on healthcare-related activities for people eligible for Medicaid. But interestingly, that was another place the governor was calling for significant cuts, even though the healthcare providers, hospitals, community-based healthcare, nursing homes, doctors, nurses were all explicitly talking to us about the impacts of having such low Medicaid reimbursement rates, our difficulties finding people to work in our hospitals and nursing homes and home care services. So we know we have a growing population that's getting older. We know we have higher healthcare costs. I wish we didn't, but we know for a fact we do. And this $4 billion more that we'll be able to draw down from the federal government is going to go a long way to addressing those concerns. But there's no tax increase on the people of New York. I think that is a complete win-win. And I would hope the governor would go, what a great idea they came up with.
Well, we've been speaking with Senate Finance Committee Chair Liz Krueger. She is a Manhattan Democrat. Senator, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
And for more budget talk with Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger, including a possible grand bargain on housing, you can visit our website. That's at nynow.org. Now turning to another budget issue, there is an ongoing push to secure a raise for New Yorkers working at nonprofits who've been contracted by the state to provide a range of services, including support for child care centers, mental health programs, domestic violence shelters, and more. This year, workers are asking for an increased cost of living adjustment in the state budget. To unpack it all, we spoke with Michelle Jackson, Executive Director for the Human Services Council.
Well, welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for starters, when we think about the nonprofit human services sector in New York, what type of work is the state government farming out to your members?
That's a great question. Human services are really embedded in every community, rural, suburban, and metropolitan across New York. And the human services sector provides a real broad range of services, everything from childcare centers and after-school programs, senior centers, home-delivered meals, mental health services, domestic violence, those experiencing homelessness. You know, it's a real broad spectrum of services, including emergency services and kind of even sports and like local gyms, community centers. Those are usually all typically run by nonprofit human services organizations. And the state of New York has really farmed out most of those human services on contract to nonprofit organizations.
And is that a recent phenomenon or has this dynamic always existed?
So it's certainly not recent. It's, you know, for the last 20, 30, even 40 years, nonprofits have really been contracted with government And I would say at least in the last 20 years, it's almost exclusively, certainly the state does retain and other counties retain some contracts themselves to provide those services. But, you know, at least for the last 20 years, it's been, you know, the majority of those contracts go out to nonprofit human services organizations.
So Governor Hochul's budget proposal includes funding for a 1.5% cost of living increase to workers at nonprofits in the human services sector, which comes on the heels of a 4% increase last year and about a 5.5% bump the year before that. So is it common for the sector to see regular cost of living raises?
Unfortunately, no. In 2008, there was a statute that was passed in the state of New York to provide a mandatory COLA each year to human service organizations or who contract with the state based on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. But since that statute wasn't enacted, it was actually taken out of the budget every year. So Governor Hochul is the first governor since that statute passed to pass a full COLA for the human services sector. And of course, with the help of the legislature. Unfortunately, what that means, though, is that nonprofit human services workers went upwards of 15 years without a real increase on their state contracts. So while these increases that have happened the last 2 years and what we're hoping to see this year are great, they only chip away at what the wages really should be in the human services sector.
And to be clear, then, the nonprofit providers might love to provide higher wages or these cost of living increases for the years when nothing is made available, but it's the state resources that really determine what they're capable of doing.
That's exactly right. A lot of these contracts last 7 to 10 years. And without any kind of COLA, it's up to nonprofits to really fundraise to fill the gaps. And understandably, there are limited resources in philanthropy and with private donors and a lot of need at those nonprofits. So they try to keep wages up, but that has created a real growing gap, resulting in nonprofit human services workers being the second lowest paid industry behind restaurant workers in New York. And unfortunately, that means a lot of workers have left the sector. And while nonprofit boards and executives are doing their best to bridge the gap and pay them equitable wages, we really need equitable wages coming from government contracts.
So the governor's budget includes, I believe, a 1.5% bump for the workforce. What sort of wage increase should be in the final budget this spring?
So we're looking for a 3.2% COLA because that's what the consumer price index would be this year. And so that's, if following the statute, what it would be. So we appreciate first that the governor has made investments in the last 2 years. The legislature really came through last year to make sure that the COLA was at 4%, which, by the way, was also not the full rate of inflation, but certainly welcome. And this year we're working with we'll be up in Albany. We have a big Albany lobby day where we have 200 people from across the state coming to really rally to ensure we get that 3.2% COLA in the budget, along with making sure that the COLA actually goes out to all workers in human services. So we're looking at some statutory changes. And then next up, we're looking at a wage board to really lift up. The COLA is so important, but we have to get real equitable wages across the sector. So we're looking at what happens past the COLA.
And how much would the governor's proposed raise cost to implement? And what's the price tag of the increase that you'd like to see?
A 3.2% COLA would be about $200 million and change. And so 1.5% is a little less than half than that. So about 90, 95 million. So we're looking for the full 3.2% to be in the final budget. And to be honest, you know, 200 million to the average New Yorker, average person sounds like a lot of money. But in regards to this budget, it's a drop in the bucket. And it also impacts upwards of 800,000 workers across the state, which I would say is a very good investment.
Yeah. And for context, as part of the revenue process, the state has basically found an additional $1.3 billion in the couch cushions that's going to be incorporated into this year's budget. So do you envision that money or just the state more broadly is in a position to foot the bill for this additional cost of living raise?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love these couch cushions where money is.
Do you ever check them at your house?
Yeah, I know exactly. I'm not finding $1.3 billion. I'm lucky if I find two quarters to rub together. Right. But we definitely think that revenue projections demonstrate alone that this would be, you know, this is not something that will harm the budget. And I will also have to say that even in a budget where we're trying to look at where we can save, we do real disservice to our communities and to our economy when we don't take the money that we do have and invest it in workers in real community jobs who lift up the economy of New York. So it's great that that money is found. And that certainly means that this investment should be a much easier lift for the governor and legislature. But regardless of the year, investing in real jobs, again, predominantly women and people of color, should be a priority in New York.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Michelle Jackson, Executive Director of the Human Services Council. Thanks so much for making the time, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me.
And in the wake of that conversation, the Democratic majorities in the state legislature came out in support of a 3.2% COLA for the human services sector, but attached spending strings. Advocates are hoping to remove those parameters from the final state budget. We'll be sure to let you know how things turn out once the final budget is passed right here on the show. And while March is prime time for negotiations, it is also Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month. This year's theme is a world of opportunities. The State Council on Developmental Disabilities has launched a campaign complete with videos and paintings from self-advocates to help bring awareness and highlight the work of the council. We sat down with the newly minted executive director of the council, Kristen Proud, as well as caucus chair, Shamika Andrews, to unpack the initiative this month and the work ahead.
Well, thank you both so much for being here. And I'm told March is Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month, and this year's theme is A World of Opportunity. So can you both speak to the background of this theme and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Sure. So as you said, Chantel, this month being Developmental Disabilities Awareness Month, we're highlighting a world of opportunities for individuals with developmental disabilities. And it really is a celebration of the successes and accomplishments and also the abilities and goals of individuals with developmental disabilities of all ages.
Absolutely. It's definitely a world of possibilities and opportunities is a great theme. Because I know for me, as an advocate in the community, that's what every program that I'm involved in is all about, is having the opportunities and giving the opportunities to people with disabilities to be involved, to be successful. So it's a great theme, and I look forward to all of the projects that we have planned.
Mm-hmm. And Shamika, you've been doing this for some time. Can you tell me about your work as a self-advocate and your work specifically as chair of the caucus?
Yes, definitely. I've been an advocate in the community for almost 20 years now. I've been a part of the caucus for many years. I've been the caucus chair for about a year now. And it's one of my... I'm a part of many things, but being a part of the caucus and is one of my favorite things, because I can say that after every meeting that we've actually truly made a difference and accomplished things. And looking at all of the grants and the projects that we've done are really making a difference to people's lives. And as an advocate, I can't say that I always can say that of everything that I've been involved in, but I can definitely say that anytime I come to a caucus meeting, that we're going to have great conversations and we're going to come up with something that's going to make a difference to so many people in the end.
Absolutely. And going back to Willowbrook briefly, you know, you said it's been over 50 years since Geraldo Rivera's groundbreaking reporting on the Willowbrook State School. And when I think of that documentary, of course, there was a lot of outrage that came out because of that. But then there was sort of a post-Willowbrook corrective era where people tried to ensure that people with developmental disabilities were being treated properly and with respect and with support. So how would you describe the current state of disability work?
I'll start and then I'll hand it off to Shamika. You know, I think we have, as I said earlier, come a long way since the days of Willowbrook. You know, certainly Willowbrook in that era was about essentially hiding a segment of our population. And that's certainly not the case now. And there are many opportunities for full inclusion in the community, from education, housing, et cetera. But I think that there's still, you know, a good deal more work to do. I think healthcare is one example. I think we all know the struggles that many people face in accessing healthcare, both in terms of healthcare coverage, but I think equally as importantly, access to healthcare providers. Certainly, the pandemic took its toll on healthcare workers, And understandably so, given the stress and the duration of the pandemic. But I think that that's made it more difficult for a lot of individuals to access health care, you know, appropriate health care in a timely manner. And that's certainly the case for individuals with developmental disabilities as well. And so I think that there's more to be done educating the healthcare sector, et cetera, about the needs and also about how to engage with individuals with developmental disabilities to ensure that they're getting appropriate and timely health care. But, you know, as I said, there are a lot of ways that things have changed and evolved since the days of Willowbrook.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. You know, I think there are a lot more people out there that are working towards making sure that people with disabilities are supported in their communities. But in order to do that, we need access to health care. We need access to employment. We need access to reliable transportation and housing, which is still a work in progress. A lot of advances have been made in those areas. But as we said, there's still a lot more work to be done, you know, and that's where, you know, the council comes in. That's where other organizations and partners come in as well to continue to make those strides, to make sure that people are able to have the possibilities and opportunities in their lives, and to continue to the work of, you know, that so many advocates started out so many years ago, like, you know, Judy Heumann, who were actually celebrating her, the passing of Judy was about a year ago. So, you know, that's where we come in, and we make room for the people that come after us and to continue that work.
And you mentioned this before, you recently came on as executive director, taking over from Vicky Haifa, who we've had on the show before. So can you talk to me about the transition of stepping into that role and what kind of legacy you're hoping to have?
Sure. So I've been the executive director since November. I came from the commissioner's office in the Department of Health. So some overlap there in terms of the work. And I think the transition has been very smooth. I'm excited to be working with people like Shamika, our chairperson, Dave Duell, who is the parent of an individual with developmental disabilities. Shamika and I have known each other. We were chatting earlier. We've known each other for probably the entire 20 years that Shamika's been an advocate. That's how we first met. And I can certainly attest to the firsthand to the power of Shamika's voice as an advocate. And so I'm really happy to be back and now working with Shamika and our other council members, and a small but very dedicated staff of individuals who are very forward-thinking and want to use the council's grant money in the best way possible to help pilot projects that can showcase ideas to improve opportunities. We have opportunities out there through our grants related to housing, related to employment. We have a really exciting multicultural initiative trying to increase access for immigrants who have developmental disabilities or have family members with DD to be able to understand what services are available in this country. Many people who immigrate from other countries come from places where there's still a great deal of societal stigma around developmental disabilities. And so I think it's very important when they come here, and certainly to New York, being the welcoming state that we are, that they understand what's available here and that they not be fearful of accessing those services.
Absolutely. And Shamika, what kind of legacy are you hoping to have as chair of the caucus?
I, you know, like I said earlier, to help people see what are the possibilities, what are the opportunities, and to continue the work of those who came, not only myself, but those who came before me, to continue to support people to have the lives of their dreams, whatever those dreams are. And because we can, even though there may be lots of work to do, there is so many great things, you know, that the council is doing, and so many of our partners as well, working together to help people see what are the possibilities, because there's so many out there to be seen.
Absolutely. Well, it's clear that you both have been doing a lot of important and impactful work, and there's even more work to be done in the future. But thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Of course. And we were speaking with Kristen Proud, Executive Director of the Council of Developmental Disabilities, and Shamika Andrews, Self-Advocate and Caucus Chair of the Council of Developmental Disabilities.
And to find more information on the State Council on Developmental Disabilities and to find the path forward Remembering Willowbrook documentary, you can visit our website. Again, that's at nynow.org. Well, that does it for this edition of New York Now. Thank you for tuning in and see you next week.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.